Chapter 3, The Impossible Task. It was past midnight and the streets were dead. I steered my pickup truck into another empty parking lot and killed the engine. In the quiet, all I could hear were the eerie halogen hum of the street lamps and the scratch of my pen as I checked off another franchise feed trough. The latest in a never-ending series of fast food and dine-in industrial kitchens that received more nightly visitors than you'd care to know about. That's why guys like me showed up to places like this in the wee hours. I stuffed my clipboard under the armrest, grabbed my gear, and began restocking rat traps. They're everywhere, those little green boxes. Look around almost any restaurant and you'll find them, hidden in plain sight. My job was to bait, move, or replace them. Sometimes I hit pay dirt and found a rat carcass, which never caught me by surprise. You know death when you smell it. This wasn't the mission I signed up for when I enlisted in the Air Force with dreams of joining a pararescue unit. Back then, I was 19 years old and weighed 175 pounds. By the time I was discharged 4 years later, I had ballooned to nearly 300 pounds and was on a different kind of patrol. At that weight, even bending down to bait the traps took effort. I was so damn fat, I had to sew an athletic sock into the crotch of my work pants so they wouldn't split when I dropped to one knee. No bullshit. I was a sorry fucking sight. With the exterior handled, it was time to venture indoors, which was its own wilderness. I had keys to almost every restaurant in this part of Indianapolis, and their alarm codes, too. Once inside, I pumped my handheld silver canister full of poison and placed a fumigation mask over my face. I looked like a damn space alien in that thing, with its dual filters jutting out from my mouth, protecting me from toxic fumes, protecting me. If there was anything I liked about that job, it was the stealth nature of working late, moving in and out of inky shadows. I loved that mask for the same reason. It was vital, and not because of any damn insecticide. I needed it because it made it impossible for anyone to see me, especially me. Even if by chance I caught my own reflection in a glass doorway or on a stainless steel countertop, it wasn't me I was seeing. It was some janky-ass, low-budget stormtrooper, the kind of guy who would palm yesterday's brownies on his way out the door. It wasn't me. Sometimes I'd see roaches scurry for cover when I flipped the lights on to spray down the counters and the tiled floors. I'd see dead rodents stuck to sticky traps I'd laid on previous visits. I bagged and dumped them. I checked the lighting systems I'd installed to catch moths and flies and clean those out, too. Within a half hour, I was gone, rolling on to the next restaurant. I had a dozen stops every night and had to hit them all before dawn. Maybe this kind of gig sounds disgusting to you. When I think back, I'm disgusted, too. But not because of the job. It was honest work. Necessary. Hell, in Air Force boot camp, I got on the wrong side of my first drill sergeant, and she made me the latrine queen. It was my job to keep the latrines in our barracks shining. She told me that if she found one speck of dirt in that latrine at any moment, I would get recycled back to day one and join a new flight. I took my discipline. I was happy just to be in the Air Force, and I cleaned the hell out of that latrine. You could have eaten off that floor. 4 years later, the guy who was so energized by opportunity that he was excited to clean latrines was gone, and I didn't feel anything at all. They say there's always light at the end of the tunnel, but not once your eyes adjust to the darkness, and that's what happened to me. I was numb. Numb to my life, miserable in my marriage, and I'd accepted that reality. I was a would-be warrior turned cockroach sniper on the graveyard shift. Just another zombie selling his time on Earth, going through the motions. In fact, the only insight I had into my job at that time was that it was actually a step up. When I first discharged from the military, I got a job at St. Vincent's Hospital. I worked security from 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. for minimum wage and cleared about $700 a month. Every now and then, I'd see an Ecolab truck pull up. We were on the exterminator's regular rotation, and it was my job to unlock the hospital kitchen for him. One night, we got to talking, and he mentioned that Ecolab was hiring, and that the job came with a free truck and no boss looking over your shoulder. It was also a 35% pay raise. I didn't think about the health risks. I didn't think at all. I was taking what was being offered. I was on that spoon-fed path of least resistance, letting dominoes fall on my head, and it was killing me slowly. But there's a difference between being numb and clueless. In the dark night, there weren't a lot of distractions to get me out of my head, and I knew that I had tipped the first domino. I'd started the chain reaction that put me on Ecolab duty. The Air Force should have been my way out. That first drill sergeant did end up recycling me into a different unit. And in my new flight, I became a star recruit. I was 6'2" and weighed about 175 pounds. I was fast and strong. Our unit was the best flight in all of boot camp, and soon I was training for my dream job, Air Force Pararescue. We were guardian angels with fangs, trained to drop from the sky behind enemy lines and pull down pilots out of harm's way. I was one of the best guys in that training. I was one of the best at push-ups and the best at sit-ups, flutter kicks, and running. I was 1 point behind honor grad, but there was something they didn't talk about in the lead-up to pararescue training. Water confidence. That's a nice name for a course where they try to drown your ass for weeks, and I was uncomfortable as hell in the water. Although my mom got us off the public dole and out of subsidized housing within 3 years, she still didn't have extra cash for swim lessons, and we avoided pools. It wasn't until I attended Boy Scout camp when I was 12 years old that I was finally confronted with swimming. Leaving Buffalo allowed me to join the Scouts, and camp was my best opportunity to score all the merit badges I'd need to stay on the path to becoming an Eagle Scout. One morning it was time to qualify for the swimming merit badge, and that meant a 1 mile swim in a lake course marked off with buoys. All the other kids jumped in and started getting after it, and if I wanted to save face, I had to pretend I knew what I was doing. So I followed them into the lake. I dog paddled the best I could, but kept swallowing water, so I flipped onto my back and ended up swimming the entire mile with a fucked up backstroke I'd improvised on the fly. Merit badge secured. When it came time to take the swim test to get into pararescue, I needed to be able to swim for real. This was a timed 500-meter freestyle swim, and even at 19 years old, I didn't know how to swim freestyle. So I took my stunted ass down to Barnes & Noble, bought swimming for dummies, studied the diagrams, and practiced in the pool every day. I hated putting my face in the water, but I managed for one stroke, then two, and before long, I could swim an entire lap. I wasn't as buoyant as most swimmers. Whenever I stopped swimming, even for a moment, I'd start to sink, which made my heart pound with panic, and my increased tension just made it worse. Eventually, I passed that swim test, but there's a difference between being competent and comfortable in the water. Another big gap from comfortable to confident, and when you can't float like most people, water confidence does not come easy. Sometimes, it doesn't come at all. In pararescue training, water confidence is part of the 10-week program, and it's filled with specific evolutions designed to test how well we perform in the water under stress. One of the worst evolutions for me was called bobbing. The class was divided into groups of five, lined up from gutter to gutter in the shallow end, and fully kitted up. Our backs were strapped with twin 80-liter tanks made from galvanized steel, and we wore 16-pound weight belts, too. We were loaded the fuck down, which would have been fine, except in this evolution, we weren't allowed to breathe from those tanks. Instead, we were told to walk backward, down the slope of the pool, from the 3-foot section to the deep end, about 10 feet down. And on that slow walk into position, my mind swirled with doubt and negativity. What the fuck are you doing here? This isn't for you. You can't swim. You're an imposter, and they will find you out. Time slowed down, and those seconds seemed like minutes. My diaphragm lurched, trying to force air into my lungs. Theoretically, I knew that relaxation was the key to all the underwater evolutions, but I was too terrified to let go. My jaw clenched as tight as my fists. My head throbbed as I worked to stave off panic. Finally, we were all in position, and it was time to start bobbing. That meant pushing up from the bottom to the surface without the benefit of finning, getting a gulp of air, and sinking back down. It wasn't easy getting up fully loaded, but at least I was able to breathe, and that first breath was a salvation. Oxygen flooded my system, and I started to relax until the instructor yelled, "Switch!" That was our cue to take our fins from our feet, place them on our hands, and use one pull with our arms to propel ourselves to the surface. We were allowed to push off the floor of the pool, but we couldn't kick. We did that for 5 minutes. Shallow water and surface blackouts aren't uncommon during water confidence training. It goes along with stressing the body and limiting oxygen intake. With the flippers on my hands, I'd barely get my face high enough out of the water to breathe, and in between, I was working hard and burning oxygen. And when you burn too much too fast, your brain shuts down, and you will black the fuck out. Our instructors called that meeting the wizard. As the clock ticked, I could see stars materializing in my peripheral vision, and felt the wizard creeping close. I passed that evolution, and soon, fitting with my arms or feet became easy for me. What stayed hard, from beginning to end, was one of our simplest tasks, treading water without our hands. We had to keep our hands and our chins high above the water, using only our legs, which we'd swirl in a blender-like motion, for 3 minutes. That doesn't sound like much time, and for most of the class it was easy. For me, it was damn near impossible. My chin kept hitting the water, which meant the time would start again from 000. All around me, my classmates were so comfortable, their legs were barely moving, while mine were whirring at top speed, and I still couldn't get half as high as those white boys who looked to be defying gravity. Every day was another humiliation in the pool. Not that I was embarrassed publicly. I passed all the evolutions, but inside I was suffering. Each night I'd fixate on the next day's task and become so terrified I couldn't sleep. And soon my fear morphed into resentment toward my classmates, who, in my mind, had it easy, which dredged up my past. I was the only black man in my unit, which reminded me of my childhood in rural Indiana, and the harder the water confidence training became, the higher those dark waters would rise, until it seemed I was also being drowned from the inside out. While the rest of my class was sleeping, that potent cocktail of fear and rage thrummed through my veins, and my nocturnal fixations became their own kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, one where failure was inevitable, because my unchecked fear was unleashing something I couldn't control, the quitting mind. It all came to a head 6 weeks into the training, with the buddy breathing exercise. We partnered up. Each pair gripped one another by the forearm and took turns breathing through just one snorkel. Meanwhile, the instructors thrashed us, trying to separate us from our snorkel. All of this was supposed to be happening at or near the surface, but I was negatively buoyant, which meant I was sinking into the middle waters of the deep end, dragging my partner down with me. He'd take a breath and pass the snorkel down to me. I'd swim to the surface, exhale, and attempt to clear the water from our snorkel and get a clean breath before passing it back to him, but the instructors made that almost impossible. I'd usually only clear the tube halfway and inhale more water than air. From the jump, I was operating from an oxygen deficit while fighting to stay near the surface. In military training, it's the instructor's job to identify weak links and challenge them to perform or quit, and they could tell I was struggling. In the pool that day, one of them was always in my face, yelling and thrashing me, while I choked, trying and failing to gulp air through a narrow tube to stave off the wizard. I went under and remember looking up at the rest of the class, splayed out like serene starfish on the surface, calm as can be. They passed their snorkels back and forth with ease, while I fumed. I know now that my instructor was just doing his job, but back then I thought, this fucker's not giving me a fair shot. I passed that evolution too, but I still had 11 more evolutions and 4 more weeks of water confidence training to go. It made sense. We would be jumping out of airplanes over water. We needed it. I just didn't want to do it anymore. And the next morning, I was offered a way out I hadn't seen coming. Weeks earlier, we'd had our blood drawn during a med check, and the doctors had just discovered I carried the sickle cell trait. I didn't have the disease, sickle cell anemia, but I had the trait, which was believed at the time to increase the risk of sudden exercise-related death due to cardiac arrest. The Air Force didn't want me dropping dead in the middle of an evolution and pulled me out of training on a medical. I pretended to take the news hard, as if my dream was being ripped away. I made a big fucking act of being pissed off, but inside, I was ecstatic. Later that week, the doctors reversed their decision. They didn't specifically say it was safe for me to continue, but they said the trait wasn't yet well understood and allowed me to decide for myself. When I reported back to training, the master sergeant informed me that I'd missed too much time and that if I wanted to continue, I would have to start over from day one, week one. Instead of less than 4 weeks, I'd have to endure another 10 weeks of the terror, rage, and insomnia that came with water confidence. These days, that kind of thing wouldn't even register on my radar. You tell me to run longer and harder than everyone else just to get a fair shake? I'd say, roger that, and keep moving. But back then, I was still half-baked. Physically, I was strong, but I was not even close to mastering my mind. The master sergeant stared at me, awaiting my response. I couldn't even look him in the eye when I said, "You know what, Master Sergeant? The doctor doesn't know much about this sickle cell thing, and it's bothering me." He nodded, emotionless, and signed the papers, pulling me out of the program for good. He cited sickle cell, and on paper I didn't quit, but I knew the truth. If I had been the guy I am today, I wouldn't have given two fucks about sickle cell. I still have the sickle cell trait. You don't just get rid of it. But back then, an obstacle had appeared, and I'd folded. I moved on to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, told my friends and family that I was forced from the program on a medical, and served out my 4 years in the Tactical Air Control Party, TACP, which works with some special operations units. I trained to liaise between ground units and air support, fast movers like F-15s and F-16s, behind enemy lines. It was challenging work with intelligent people, but sadly I was never proud of it and didn't see the opportunities offered because I knew I was a quitter who had let fear dictate my future. I buried my shame in the gym and at the kitchen table. I got into powerlifting and layered on the mass. I ate and worked out and ate. In my last days in the Air Force, I weighed 255 pounds. After my discharge, I continued to bulk up with both muscle and fat until I weighed nearly 300 pounds. I wanted to be big because being big hid David Goggins. I was able to tuck this 175-pound person into those 21-inch biceps and that flabby belly. I grew a burly mustache and was intimidating to everyone who saw me, but inside I knew I was a pussy, and that's a haunting feeling. The morning I began to take charge of my destiny started out like any other. When the clock struck 7 a.m., my Ecolab shift ended, and I hit the Steak and Shake drive-thru to score a large chocolate milkshake. Next stop, 7-Eleven, for a box of Hostess mini chocolate donuts. I gobbled those on my 45-minute drive home to a beautiful apartment on a golf course in pretty Carmel, Indiana, which I shared with my wife, Pam, and her daughter. Remember that Pizza Hut incident? I married that girl. I married a girl whose dad called me a nigger. What does that say about me? We couldn't afford that life. Pam wasn't even working, but in those credit card debt-loading days, nothing made much sense. I was doing 70 miles per hour on the highway, mainlining sugar and listening to a local classic rock station when Sound of Silence poured from the stereo. Simon and Garfunkel's words echoed like truth. Darkness was a friend indeed. I worked in the dark, hid my true self from friends and strangers. Nobody would have believed how numb and afraid I was back then because I looked like a beast that no one would dare fuck with. But my mind wasn't right, and my soul was weighed down by too much trauma and failure. I had every excuse in the world to be a loser, and used them all. My life was crumbling, and Pam dealt with that by fleeing the scene. Her parents still lived in Brazil, just 70 miles away. We spent most of our time apart. I arrived home from work around 8 a.m., and the phone rang as soon as I walked in the door. It was my mother. She knew my routine. "Come on over for your staple," she said. My staple was a breakfast buffet for one, the likes of which few could put down in a single sitting. Think 8 Pillsbury cinnamon rolls, a half dozen scrambled eggs, a half pound of bacon, and 2 bowls of Fruity Pebbles. Don't forget, I had just decimated a box of donuts and a chocolate shake. I didn't even have to respond. She knew I was coming. Food was my drug of choice, and I always sucked up every last crumb. I hung up, flipped on the television, and stomped down the hall to the shower, where I could hear a narrator's voice filter through the steam. I caught snippets. Navy SEALs. Toughest. The world. I wrapped a towel around my waist and rushed back into the living room. I was so big, the towel barely covered my fat ass, but I sat down on the couch and didn't move for 30 minutes. The show followed basic underwater demolition SEAL, BUDS, training class 224, through Hell Week, the most arduous series of tasks in the most physically demanding training in the military. I watched men sweat and suffer as they tore through muddy obstacle courses, ran on the soft sand holding logs overhead, and shivered in icy surf. Sweat pearled on my scalp. I was literally on the edge of my seat as I saw guys, some of the strongest of them all, ring the bell and quit. Made sense. Only 1/3 of the men who begin BUDS make it through Hell Week. And in all of my time in pararescue training, I couldn't remember feeling as awful as these men looked. They were swollen, chafed, sleep-deprived, and dead on their feet. And I was jealous of them. The longer I watched, the more certain I became that there were answers buried in all that suffering. Answers that I needed. More than once, the camera panned over the endless, frothing ocean, and each time I felt pathetic. The seals were everything I wasn't. They were about pride, dignity, and the type of excellence that came from bathing in the fire, getting beat the fuck down, and going back for more, again and again. They were the human equivalent of the hardest, sharpest sword you could imagine. They sought out the flame, took the pounding for as long as necessary, longer even, until they were fearless and deadly. They weren't motivated. They were driven. The show ended with graduation. 22 proud men stood shoulder to shoulder in their dress whites before the camera pushed in on their commanding officer. In a society where mediocrity is too often the standard and too often rewarded, he said, there is intense fascination with men who detest mediocrity, who refuse to define themselves in conventional terms, and who seek to transcend traditionally recognized human capabilities. This is exactly the type of person Buds is meant to find. The man who finds a way to complete each and every task to the best of his ability. The man who will adapt and overcome any and all obstacles. In that moment, it felt as though the commanding officer was talking directly to me. But after the show ended, I walked back to the bathroom, faced the mirror, and stared myself down. I looked every bit of 300 pounds. I was everything all the haters back home said I would be. Uneducated, with no real-world skills, zero discipline, and a dead-end future. Mediocrity would have been a major promotion. I was at the bottom of the barrel of life, pooling in the dregs. But for the first time in way too long, I was awake. I barely spoke to my mother during breakfast and only ate half my staple because my mind was on unfinished business. I'd always wanted to join an elite special operations unit, and beneath all the rolls of flesh and layers of failure, that desire was still there. Now it was coming back to life, thanks to a chance viewing of a show that continued to work on me like a virus moving cell to cell, taking over. It became an obsession I couldn't shake. Every morning after work for almost 3 weeks, I called active duty recruiters in the Navy and told them my story. I called offices all over the country. I said I was willing to move as long as they could get me to SEAL training. Everyone turned me down. Most weren't interested in candidates with prior service. One local recruiting office was intrigued and wanted to meet in person, but when I got there, they laughed in my face. I was way too heavy, and in their eyes, I was just another delusional pretender. I left that meeting feeling the same way. After calling all the active duty recruiting offices I could find, I dialed the local unit of the Naval Reserves and spoke to Petty Officer Steven Shaljo for the first time. Shaljo had worked with multiple F-14 squadrons as an electrician and instructor at NAS Miramar for 8 years before joining the recruitment staff in San Diego, where the SEALs train. He worked day and night and rose quickly in the ranks. His move to Indianapolis came with a promotion and the challenge of finding Navy recruits in the middle of the corn. He'd only been on the job in Indy for 10 days by the time I called, and if I'd reached anyone else, you probably wouldn't be listening to this book. But through a combination of dumb luck and stubborn persistence, I found one of the finest recruiters in the Navy, a guy whose favorite task was discovering diamonds in the rough. Prior service guys like me who are looking to re-enlist and hoping to land in special operations. Our initial conversation didn't last long. He said he could help me and that I should come in to meet in person. That sounded familiar. I grabbed my keys and drove straight to his office, but didn't get my hopes too high. By the time I arrived a half hour later, he was already on the phone with Bud's administration. Every sailor in that office, all of them white, were surprised to see me, except Shaljo. If I was a heavyweight, Shaljo was a lightweight at 5'7", but he didn't seem fazed by my size, at least not at first. He was outgoing and warm, like any salesman, though I could tell he had some pit bull in him. He led me down a hall to weigh me in, and while standing on the scale, I eyed a weight chart pinned to the wall. At my height, the maximum allowable weight for the Navy was 191 pounds. I held my breath, sucked in my gut as much as I could, and puffed out my chest in a sorry attempt to stave off the humiliating moment where he let me down easy. That moment never came. "You're a big boy," Shaljo said, smiling and shaking his head as he scratched 297 pounds on a chart in his file folder. The Navy has a program that allows recruits in the reserves to become active duty. That's what we'll use for this. It's being phased out at the end of the year, so we need to get you classed up before then. Point is, you have some work to do, but you knew that. I followed his eyes to the weight chart and checked it again. He nodded, smiled, patted me on the shoulder, and left me to face my truth. I had less than 3 months to lose 106 pounds. It sounded like an impossible task, which is one reason I didn't quit my job. The other was the ASVAB. That nightmare test had come back to life like Frankenstein's fucking monster. I'd passed it once before to enlist in the Air Force, but to qualify for BUDS, I'd have to score much higher. For 2 weeks, I studied all day and zapped pests each night. I wasn't working out yet. Serious weight loss would have to wait. I took the test on a Saturday afternoon. The following Monday, I called Sheljo. "Welcome to the Navy," he said. He downloaded the good news first. I'd done exceptionally well on some sections. I was now officially a reservist, but I'd only scored a 44 on mechanical comprehension. To qualify for BUDS, I needed a 50. I'd have to retake the entire test in 5 weeks. These days, Stephen Sheljo likes to call our chance connection fate. He said he could sense my drive the first moment we spoke, and that he believed in me from the jump, which is why my weight wasn't an issue for him. But after that ASVAB test, I was full of doubt. So maybe what happened later that night was also a form of fate, or a much-needed dose of divine intervention. I'm not going to drop the name of the restaurant where it went down, because if I did, you'd never eat there again, and I'd have to hire a lawyer. Just know, this place was a disaster. I checked the traps outside first and found a dead rat. Inside, there were more dead rodents, a mouse and 2 rats, on the sticky traps, and roaches in the garbage which hadn't been emptied. I shook my head, got down on my knees under the sink, and sprayed up through a narrow gap in the wall. I didn't know it yet, but I'd found their nesting column, and when the poison hit, they started to scatter. Within seconds, there was a skittering across the back of my neck. I brushed it off and craned my neck to see a storm of roaches raining down to the kitchen floor from an open panel in the ceiling. I'd hit the mother load of cockroaches, and the worst infestation I ever saw on the job for Ecolab. They kept coming. Roaches landed on my shoulders and my head. The floor was writhing with them. I left my canister in the kitchen, grabbed the sticky traps, and burst outside. I needed fresh air and more time to figure out how I was going to clear the restaurant of vermin. I considered my options on my way to the dumpster to trash the rodents, opened the lid, and found a live raccoon, hissing mad. He bared his yellow teeth and lunged at me. I slammed the dumpster shut. What the fuck? I mean, seriously, what the fucking fuck? When was enough truly going to be enough? Was I willing to let my sorry present become a fucked up future? How much longer would I wait? How many more years would I burn, wondering if there was some greater purpose out there waiting for me? I knew right then that if I didn't make a stand and start walking the path of most resistance, I would end up in this mental hell forever. I didn't go back inside that restaurant. I didn't collect my gear. I started my truck, stopped for a chocolate shake, my comfort tea at that time, and drove home. It was still dark when I pulled up. I didn't care. I stripped off my work clothes, put on some sweats, and laced up my running shoes. I hadn't run in over a year, but I hit the streets ready to go 4 miles. I lasted 400 yards. My heart raced. I was so dizzy I had to sit down on the edge of the golf course to catch my breath before making the slow walk back to my house, where my melted shake was waiting to comfort me in yet another failure. I grabbed it, slurped, and slumped into my sofa. My eyes welled with tears. Who the fuck did I think I was? I was born nothing, I'd proven nothing, and I still wasn't worth a damn thing. David Goggins, a Navy SEAL? Yeah, right. What a pipe dream. I couldn't even run down the block for 5 minutes. All my fears and insecurities I'd bottled up for my entire life started raining down on my head. I was on the verge of giving in and giving up for good. That's when I found my old beat-to-shit VHS copy of Rocky, the one I'd had for 15 years, slid it into the machine, and fast-forwarded to my favorite scene, Round 14. The original Rocky is still one of my all-time favorite films because it's about a know-nothing journeyman fighter living in poverty with no prospects. Even his own trainer won't work with him. Then, out of the blue, he's given a title shot with a champion, Apollo Creed, the most feared fighter in history, a man that has knocked out every opponent he's ever faced. All Rocky wants is to be the first to go the distance with Creed. That alone will make him someone he could be proud of for the first time in his life. The fight is closer than anyone anticipated, bloody and intense, and by the middle rounds, Rocky is taking on more and more punishment. He's losing the fight, and in round 14, he gets knocked down early, but pops right back up in the center of the ring. Apollo moves in, stalking him like a lion. He throws sharp left jabs, hits a slow-footed Rocky with a staggering combination, lands a punishing right hook, and another. He backs Rocky into a corner. Rocky's legs are jelly. He can't even muster the strength to raise his arms in defense. Apollo slams another right hook into the side of Rocky's head, then a left hook, and a vicious right-handed uppercut that puts Rocky down. Apollo retreats to the opposite corner with his arms held high. But even face down in that ring, Rocky doesn't give up. As the referee begins his 10 count, Rocky squirms toward the ropes. Mickey, his own trainer, urges him to stay down, but Rocky isn't hearing it. He pulls himself up to one knee, then all fours. The referee hits 6 as Rocky grabs the ropes and rises up. The crowd roars, and Apollo turns to see him still standing. Rocky waves Apollo over. The champ's shoulders slump in disbelief. The fight isn't over yet. I turned off the television and thought about my own life. It was a life devoid of any drive and passion. But I knew if I continued to surrender to my fear and my feelings of inadequacy, I would be allowing them to dictate my future forever. My only other choice was to try to find the power in the emotions that had laid me low, harness and use them to empower me to rise up, which is exactly what I did. I dumped that shake in the trash, laced up my shoes, and hit the streets again. On my first run, I felt severe pain in my legs and my lungs at a quarter mile. My heart raced and I stopped. This time I felt the same pain. My heart raced like a car running hot, but I ran through it and the pain faded. By the time I bent over to catch my breath, I'd run a full mile. That's when I first realized that not all physical and mental limitations are real, and that I had a habit of giving up way too soon. I also knew that it would take every ounce of courage and toughness I could muster to pull off the impossible. I was staring at hours, days, and weeks of nonstop suffering. I would have to push myself to the very edge of my mortality. I had to accept the very real possibility that I might die, because this time I wouldn't quit, no matter how fast my heart raced, and no matter how much pain I was in. Trouble was, there was no battle plan to follow, no blueprint. I had to create one from scratch. The typical day went something like this. I'd wake up at 4:30 a.m., munch a banana, and hit the ASVAB books. Around 5 a.m., I'd take that book to my stationary bike, where I'd sweat and study for 2 hours. Remember, my body was a mess. I couldn't run multiple miles yet, so I had to burn as many calories as I could on the bike. After that, I'd drive over to Carmel High School and jump into the pool for a 2-hour swim. From there, I hit the gym for a circuit workout that included the bench press, the incline press, and lots of leg exercises. Bulk was the enemy. I needed reps, and I did 5 or 6 sets of 100 to 200 reps each. Then it was back to the stationary bike for 2 more hours. I was constantly hungry. Dinner was my one true meal each day, but there wasn't much to it. I ate a grilled or sautéed chicken breast and some sautéed vegetables along with a thimble of rice. After dinner, I'd do another 2 hours on the bike, hit the sack, wake up and do it all over again, knowing the odds were stacked sky high against me. What I was trying to achieve is like a D student applying to Harvard, or walking into a casino and putting every single dollar you own on a number in roulette and acting as if winning is a foregone conclusion. I was betting everything I had on myself with no guarantees. I weighed myself twice daily, and within 2 weeks I dropped 25 pounds. My progress only improved as I kept grinding, and the weight started peeling off. 10 days later, I was at 250, light enough to begin doing push-ups, pull-ups, and to start running my ass off. I'd still wake up, hit the stationary bike, the pool, and the gym, but I also incorporated 2, 3, and 4-mile runs. I ditched my running shoes and ordered a pair of Bates Lights, the same boots SEAL candidates wear in Buds, and started running in those. With so much effort, you'd think my nights would have been restful, but they were filled with anxiety. My stomach growled and my mind swirled. I'd dream of complex ASVAB questions and dread the next day's workouts. I was putting out so much on almost no fuel that depression became a natural side effect. My splintering marriage was veering toward divorce. Pam made it very clear that she and my stepdaughter would not be moving to San Diego with me, if by some miracle I could pull this off. They stayed in Brazil most of the time, and when I was all alone in Carmel, I was in turmoil. I felt both worthless and helpless as my endless stream of self-defeating thoughts picked up steam. When depression smothers you, it blots out all light and leaves you with nothing to cling onto for hope. All you see is negativity. For me, the only way to make it through that was to feed off my depression. I had to flip it and convince myself that all that self-doubt and anxiety was confirmation that I was no longer living an aimless life. My task may turn out to be impossible, but at least I was back on a motherfucking mission. Some nights when I was feeling low, I'd call Shaljo. He was always in the office early in the morning and late at night. I didn't confide in him about my depression because I didn't want him to doubt me. I used those calls to pump myself up. I told him how many pounds I dropped and how much work I was putting in, and he reminded me to keep studying for that ASVAB. Roger that. I had the Rocky soundtrack on cassette, and I'd listen to Going the Distance for inspiration. On long bike rides and runs, with those horns blasting in my brain, I'd imagine myself going through buds, diving into cold water, and crushing Hell Week. I was wishing, I was hoping. But by the time I was down to 250, my quest to qualify for the SEALs wasn't a daydream anymore. I had a real chance to accomplish something most people, including myself, thought was impossible. Still, there were bad days. One morning, not long after I dipped below 250, I weighed in, and I'd only lost a pound from the day before. I had so much weight to lose, I could not afford to plateau. That's all I thought about while running 6 miles and swimming two. I was exhausted and sore when I arrived in the gym for my typical 3-hour circuit. After rocking over 100 pull-ups in a series of sets, I was back on the bar for a max set with no ceiling. Going in, my goal was to get to 12, but my hands were burning fire as I stretched my chin over the bar for the 10th time. For weeks, the temptation to pull back had been ever-present, and I always refused. That day, however, the pain was too much, and after my 11th pull-up, I gave in, dropped down, and finished my workout, one pull-up shy. That one rep stayed with me, along with that 1 pound. I tried to get them out of my head, but they wouldn't leave me the fuck alone. They taunted me on the drive home and at my kitchen table while I ate a sliver of grilled chicken and a bland baked potato. I knew I wouldn't sleep that night unless I did something about it, so I grabbed my keys. "You cut corners and you are not gonna fucking make it," I said out loud as I drove back to the gym. "There are no shortcuts for you, Goggins." I did my entire pull-up workout over again. One missed pull-up cost me an extra 250, and there would be similar episodes. Whenever I cut a run or swim short because I was hungry or tired, I'd always go back and beat myself down even harder. That was the only way I could manage the demons in my mind. Either way, there would be suffering. I had to choose between physical suffering in the moment and the mental anguish of wondering if that one missed pull-up, that last lap in the pool, the quarter mile I skipped on the road or trail would end up costing me an opportunity of a lifetime. It was an easy choice. When it came to the SEALs, I wasn't leaving anything up to chance. On the eve of the ASVAB, with 4 weeks to go before training, making weight was no longer a worry. I was already down to 215 pounds and was faster and stronger than I'd ever been. I was running 6 miles a day, bicycling over 20 miles, and swimming more than two, all of it in the dead of winter. My favorite run was the 6-mile Monon Trail, an asphalt bike and walking path that laced through the trees in Indianapolis. It was the domain of cyclists and soccer moms with jogging strollers, weekend warriors and seniors. By then, Shaljo had passed along the Navy SEAL warning order. It included all the workouts I would be expected to complete during the first phase of BUDS, and I was happy to double them. I knew that 190 men usually class up for a typical SEAL training, and only about 40 people make it all the way through. I didn't want to be just one of those 40. I wanted to be the best. But I had to pass the damn ASVAB first. I'd been cramming every spare second. If I wasn't working out, I was at my kitchen table, memorizing formulas and cycling through hundreds of vocabulary words. With my physical training going well, all my anxieties stuck to the ASVAB like paper clips to a magnet. This would be my last chance to take the test before my eligibility for the SEALs expired. I wasn't very smart, and based on past academic performance, there was no good reason to believe I'd pass with a score high enough to qualify for the SEALs. If I failed, my dream would die, and I'd be floating without purpose once again. The test was held in a small classroom on Fort Benjamin Harrison in Indianapolis. There were about 30 people there, all of us young. Most were just out of high school. We were each assigned an old school desktop computer. In the past month, the test had been digitized, and I wasn't experienced with computers. I didn't even think I could work the damn machine, let alone answer the questions. But the program proved idiot-proof, and I settled in. The ASVAB has 10 sections, and I was breezing through until I reached mechanical comprehension, my truth serum. Within the hour, I would have a decent idea if I'd been lying to myself, or if I had the raw stuff necessary to become a SEAL. Whenever a question stumped me, I marked my worksheet with a dash. There were about 30 questions in that section, and by the time I completed the test, I'd guessed at least 10 times. I needed some of them to go my way, or I was out. After completing the final section, I was prompted to send the entire bundle to the administrator's computer at the front of the room, where the score would be tabulated instantly. I peeked over my monitor and saw him sitting there, waiting. I pointed, clicked, and left the room. Buzzing with nervous energy, I paced the parking lot for a few minutes before finally ducking into my Honda Accord, but I didn't start the engine. I couldn't leave. I sat in the front seat for 15 minutes with a 1,000-yard stare. It would be at least 2 days before Xiaojo would call with my results, but the answer to the riddle that was my future was already solved. I knew exactly where it was, and I had to know the truth. I gathered myself, walked back in, and approached the fortune teller. "You gotta tell me what I got on this fucking test, man," I said. He peered up at me, surprised, but he didn't buckle. "I'm sorry, son. This is the government. There's a system for how they do things," he said. "I didn't make the rules, and I can't bend them." "Sir, you have no idea what this test means to me, to my life. It's everything." He looked into my glassy eyes for what felt like 5 minutes, then turned toward his machine. "I'm breaking every rule in the book right now," he said. "Goggins, right?" I nodded and came around behind his seat as he scrolled through files. "There you are. Congratulations, you scored 65. That's a great score." He was referencing my overall, but I didn't care about that. Everything hinged on my getting a 50 spot where it counted most. "What did I get on mechanical comprehension?" He shrugged, clicked, and scrolled, and there it was. My new favorite number glowed on his screen. 50. "Yes!" I shouted. "Yes! Yes!" There were still a handful of others taking the test, but this was the happiest moment in my life, and I couldn't stifle it. I kept screaming, "Yes!" at the top of my lungs. The administrator damn near fell out of his chair, and everyone in that room stared at me like I was crazy. If they only knew how crazed I'd been. For 2 months, I dedicated my entire existence toward this one moment, and I was damn well gonna enjoy it. I rushed to my car and screamed some more. "Fuck yeah!" On my drive home, I called my mom. She was the one person, aside from Xiaojo, who witnessed my metamorphosis. "I fucking did it," I told her, tears in my eyes. "I fucking did it! I'm going to be a SEAL!" When Xiaojo came to work the next day, he got the news and called me up. He'd sent in my recruitment package and had just heard back that I was in. I could tell he was happy for me and proud that what he saw in me the first time we met turned out to be real. But it wasn't all happy days. My wife had given me an implied ultimatum, and now I had a decision to make. Abandon the opportunity I'd worked so hard for and stay married, or get divorced and go try and become a SEAL. In the end, my choice didn't have anything to do with my feelings for Pam or her father. He'd apologized to me, by the way. It was about who I was and who I wanted to be. I was a prisoner in my own mind, and this opportunity was my only chance to break free. I celebrated my victory the way any SEAL candidate should. I put the fuck out. The following morning, and for the next 3 weeks, I spent time in the pool, strapped with a 16-pound weight belt. I swam underwater for 50 meters at a time, and walked the length of the pool underwater with a brick in each hand, all in a single breath. The water would not own my ass this time. When I was done, I'd swim a mile or two, then head to a pond near my mother's home. Remember, this was Indiana, the American Midwest, in December. The trees were naked, icicles hung like crystals from the eaves of houses, and snow blanketed the earth in all directions. But the pond wasn't completely frozen yet. I waded into the icy water, dressed in camo pants, a brown short-sleeved t-shirt, and boots, laid back and looked into the gray sky. The hypothermic water washed over me. The pain was excruciating, and I fucking loved it. After a few minutes, I got out and started running, water sloshing in my boots, sand in my underwear. Within seconds, my t-shirt was frozen to my chest, my pants iced at the cuffs. I hit the Monon Trail. Steam poured from my nose and mouth as I grunted and slalomed speedwalkers and joggers. Civilians. Their heads turned as I picked up speed and began sprinting like Rocky in downtown Philly. I ran as fast as I could, for as long as I could. From a past that no longer defined me, toward a future undetermined. All I knew was that there would be pain, and there would be purpose, and that I was ready. That was an impossible task.
You know what, man? When I hear you read that, still to this day, it makes me very emotional. And like that scene with me taking the ASVAB test and me walking back out to the car and me walking around and then me getting in my car, then me coming back in and literally begging the guy. I mean, I was literally almost crying because my whole life was just sitting on that 50.
Mm.
And so what people never, you know, we did a good job of making that scene as powerful as it is. But, you know, this whole book of mine, it went to auction, as you know, Adam. And that scene that you just read, this chapter that you just read, this is one of the main reasons why, you know, I got offered $300,000 for my book.
Mm.
And that chapter that you just read is a major reason why I couldn't sell my life to anybody.
Hmm.
Going back through, listening to you, you know, just pretty much read my life story in that section, and there's so much more things to come. It made me realize why this is the only trophy. This is the only trophy that I would truly, you know, have in my life. And that chapter is where this really started for me. I started really figuring out what life was all about. You know, I didn't figure it out completely. But, you know, you talking that, you know, you reading that story, it lets me know why there wasn't any amount of money that I was going to take for the shit I put myself through to be where I'm at today.
It's very interesting. I want to go on record as saying I encourage you to take that book deal, which is the wrong decision. Right. As we'll soon know, it would have been the wrong decision. So
right.
never listen to me about business. But I will say that I could understand it because it seems to me that you were in a not just a physical bunker mentality, but a mental and emotional bunker mentality. Yeah, your mom could penetrate the bunker a little bit, but really you had to be in your own bunker.
Right.
And that's a very lonely and isolating place to be. I mean, going through this journey with you and hearing what you had to go through, you know, my heart goes out to you because you had basically put it all on this. Now, you know, you might have come out of this, if you failed, we don't know what would have happened. Would all of that hard work dissipated? Would you have had to go back and get some wage job? Would you have never achieved anything? We don't really know. But in your mind at that moment, you couldn't afford that. Like there was, you didn't have the slack to give yourself.
Right.
You know, you had to go forward. You had to do this, or the odds were you were going to be the statistic you were always supposed to be.
And that was the hard part about this was, I couldn't give myself even a little break.
Yeah.
And there was sometimes I would literally look at my running shoes for 30 to 40 minutes, because when you're that big. I mean, I was so broken every single day, you know.
Yeah.
I would literally look at all these. Okay, now I would get done running 6 miles and know I had, you know, 2 hours on the bike and then there are 2 hours at nighttime and I had to go swim 2 more miles and I had 3 hours in the gym. And just knowing that there was every single fucking day you were going to have to relive this hell. And there were some days I couldn't even get out of bed. I was so sore. And then to know that I had to get out of bed and literally like for the first hour and a half, you know, my body just didn't want to move and to force it.
Is it hard to also study and kind of do the hard intellectual work while you're sore like that? That must be really hard, right? I mean, it's not a break.
Well, that's what sucked for me also was I was literally so I had to earn. I never sat down. I had to always earn my right to watch TV. So how I did that was I got a stationary bike, put it in my house cheap Walmart stationary bike, and I would be there, and I had a, I kind of propped up some, you know, those like little eating tables, and I put my books on there, and I was just studying, and I would study all, I was so obsessed, and that's one thing I talk about when I tell people about motivation. I always say motivation is crap. And people go, you know, how do you say that? All it is, you know, it's just a little bit of kindling. That's all it is. You know, you have to be like for instance, some people are going to read this book and be so fucking motivated and they're going to have a bad day. Mm. And on that bad day, their motivation is going to be fucking gone. It's going to be gone. So I realized about, you know, that about the human mind, that I had to be more than motivated. I had to be more than driven. I had to become literally obsessed to the point where people thought I was fucking nuts. You know, like the colder it was, the better it was. The more I suffered, the more I had to just literally take all of this stuff and wrap it up and just be like, okay, fuck it. This is what's going to happen now. And I had to start really just callousing my mind.
It's, you know, just reading these chapters that we read today, and for listeners, we're being super transparent. We're recording this over a period of 5 days, and these first three chapters are done in the first session. And you know what I think is so interesting about this book and your life? It's the way you crack stereotypes. And I'm not talking about ethnic stereotypes. I'm talking about, you know, Sister Catherine, how you don't, you're never going to judge a smile or a scowl.
Right.
You know, it's the same idea when I hear this. It's like, we don't know what the people that we interact with in our hometowns and the cities that we live in, what they're going through. And, you know, I could picture you, in bunker mentality, not giving anybody any smiles, being all business and people taking that personally. When in reality, you're trying to do something really important for yourself. And it's all about your own journey, and you didn't have any hate towards anybody else.
Right.
And that's, and there's people out there all the time going through what they're going through, and you just can't judge it. And it's very interesting. That's what I love about what you do, because I think that you kind of recalibrate, what we expect from people.
Right.
And how to appreciate people.
And see, even now, you know, you guys have heard my story, at least a fraction of it, about how I got called nigger. And, you know, I hate no one. I just like some people just because of some issues that we have. You know, when you are constantly judged your whole life, when you are, as we call it in the book, the only your whole life, how the fuck am I now going to walk around in my, you know, in this world I live in and judge anybody? Because I know how it feels to be judged. And what's so stupid is so many people who have been judged, they now judge other people. We forget how it feels to be the only person, how it feels to be judged. I don't forget it. I remember, so I'm all about people being whoever the hell they are, be it, own it, wear it like a fucking badge of honor.
Love it. And so the next challenge is, it's kind of the first step on the journey towards callousing your mind. That's how we start the next challenge. And that's what this was, right? This is where you really started to callous your mind, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, for sure. This is when I started literally trying to callous over that whole victim's mentality.
Challenge 3. The first step on the journey toward a calloused mind is stepping outside your comfort zone on a regular basis. Dig out your journal again and write down all the things you don't like to do or that make you uncomfortable, especially those things you know are good for you. Now go do one of them, and do it again. In the coming pages, I'll be asking you to mirror what you just read to some degree, but there is no need for you to find your own impossible task and achieve it on the fast track. This is not about changing your life instantly. It's about moving the needle bit by bit and making those changes sustainable. That means digging down to the micro level and doing something that sucks every day. Even if it's as simple as making your bed, doing the dishes, ironing your clothes, or getting up before dawn and running 2 miles each day. Once that becomes comfortable, take it to 5, then 10 miles. If you already do all those things, find something you aren't doing. We all have areas in our lives we either ignore or can improve upon. Find yours. We often choose to focus on our strengths rather than our weaknesses. Use this time to make your weaknesses your strengths. Doing things, even small things, that make you uncomfortable will help make you strong. The more often you get uncomfortable, the stronger you'll become. and soon you'll develop a more productive, can-do dialogue with yourself in stressful situations. Take a photo or video of yourself in the discomfort zone. Post it on social media describing what you're doing and why. And don't forget to include the hashtags. Hashtag discomfort zone. Hashtag path of most resistance. Hashtag can't hurt me. Hashtag impossible task. So this one, you're not giving them a specific thing. You're asking them to look inside and figure out what they don't like to do. This is about really getting out of your comfort zone, because that's what you had to do when you were kind of in your own fugue state with no purpose.
Right. You know, one question I get all the time is, man, how did you become so damn mentally strong? How did you do this? I think everybody knows the answer. Everybody knows the answer, but they would love for me to give you a nice, simple, hey, it really is easy. That's what they want to hear. But the truth of the matter is this, man. Honestly, the only way you are ever going to become hard and learn to callous your mind is you have to do the things that you do not want to do. There's no way around it. Like a lot of people, if you like running, they will run. They'll just keep on running. I'm not saying don't do things you don't enjoy, but I'm saying that if you're looking for the advantage, if you're trying to get the advantage, you have to do those things that kind of make you say, oh man, I really don't want to do this shit right now. That's going to really challenge me mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually. Those are the things you have to start gravitating to. Like a lot of people say, triple down on your strengths. Yeah, that's good for some things. But if you want to fucking really get hard and become that hardened person and get true mental toughness, you have to triple down on your weaknesses. And that's the only way you can start to callous that mind and start callousing over all of that. You know, you have to learn to callous over that victim's mentality.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when people say triple down on your strengths, they're basically implying pick a lane, do that, become an expert in one thing. But you're not talking to people about what you went through to make them an expert in anything. Your whole thing about callousing the mind, becoming better, is to make them a more unbreakable human being. And that's emotionally and physically and mentally. And I think that that's a very different thing. And don't you think that's your purpose? I mean, you're not trying to get someone to become the best this or that.
No.
I mean, that's shallow, really, if you think about
it. It's 100% shallow. And once again, you know, you're listening to my story right now. This isn't about me. This is about me challenging you to look inward and to start, you know, developing that hero inside of you. And these are all steps for you to, you know, not even steps. These are things for you to take on board in your life and think about, you know what? I could be doing more. I am afraid of this. I don't want to do that. You know, so just look at yourself and start challenging yourself even more.
You know, you saying that makes me think of something else, is that we've talked about this before. And that is, you know, all of this thing, this great task that you just accomplished in this chapter, that didn't give you anything really other than another opportunity to fail.
You know what? That's 100% correct, man. Like, you know, so it wasn't like Steven Saljo came, you know, miracled me and said, hey man, if you lose 106 pounds and you pass the ASVAB, I'm going to miracle a Navy SEAL Trident on your chest.
No.
You know, this was all a chance. And that's the thing about life is a lot of us are not, if we're not guaranteed something, we don't want to take that chance. We're looking at it like right now, I could easily sit back and say, oh my God, losing 106 pounds. There's not even, you know, I may not even graduate BUDS or, you know, retake the ASVAB test. I might even graduate BUDS. If that is your mindset and that is your thinking, you have already lost. You have already lost. All this is you have to put yourself in a position to win. Some of us don't even want to put ourselves in a position to win. So I knew losing 106 pounds, taking the ASVAB test again, was just me putting myself in a position to succeed. But most of us don't have the courage to put ourselves in a position to win. Why? Because failing is almost too much to handle. So why even try? Why even try? Because if I never tried, I can never fail. So that's the mindset of a lot of people.
But, you know, in this case, it's not just a small risk. First of all, you're preparing to walk away from your marriage.
Right.
And, you know, the success rate for a seal and buds is 20%.
Exactly.
And so you do all this, you put all this out, and now you have a 20% chance of taking the next step. I mean, you still had a lot on the line and a lot ahead of you.
But you know what the beauty of that is, Adam? Is I had so much on the line and so much ahead of me, but what was happening when I was losing that weight and I was passing the ASVAB and I was going through all these daily struggles, I started finding a whole new David Goggins. Mm. That was the power of all this. My confidence started growing. So if you can lose 106 pounds in 3 months, what the fuck else can I do? Mm. If I can go back and retake the ASVAB and fail and fail and fail, and continue to, you know, strive for excellence in failure, all that was doing for me was making me more and more psyched up to be better. So I was just constantly fueling the machine. So even though it wasn't guaranteed I was going to get through SEAL training, my chances were looking pretty fucking good.